Welcome to the Resilient Recruiter Podcast. This is your host, Mark Whitby, and I'm joined today by Ross Eads. Ross is the CEO of Red Commerce, a global leader in placing SAP professionals with 250 employees in six locations around the world. Prior to joining Red Commerce in 2018, Ross was the CEO of Horton Group International, a global executive search and leadership firm with 50 offices in 32 countries. Ross has a phenomenal track record as a CEO within the recruiting and staffing industry. He built Modus Professional Services Group International into a $300 million turnover business with 800 staff. He has taken a private business through an IPO to successful flotation and listed on the London Stock Exchange. Previous successes include developing InterQuest Group from a $10 million pound turnover business to £100 million in revenue. So Ross, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Mark.
You've been at this a long time, I guess. So you've got lots of experience to share with us today. Listen, Red Commerce is your current business, and it's one we'll probably spend the most time talking about. You successfully led the firm through the pandemic. Which, you know, has been devastating, if not, you know, devastating or difficult for most of the industry. You guys managed to rank number three on Recruiter Magazine's Hot 100 list. So that's out of 30 or 40,000 recruitment companies in the UK. And you guys were the third most successful, at least in terms of your GP per employee, which is an indicator of efficiency and productivity for sure. So really keen to learn how you did that. But Ross, could you start by telling the story of how you built up InterQuest Group PLC?
Okay. I mean, InterQuest was a great journey, great enjoyable job. I'd obviously gone from a large company, MPS, down to a smaller one, but the ambitions that I had and we have a chairman at the time and a non-exec that we had, was to grow this company over a five-year period through a buy and build. And halfway through the five-year period, list it on the stock market. And it was great. You know, it was a really good experience. The IPO was probably, well, it was a new thing for me to be involved in. And yeah, we aim to get take up of about 30% of the share capital, and this would give the management team a couple of things really. One, a chance to see what their shares were really worth once it was on the stock market, and more importantly, gave us the ability to acquire companies through paper with paper and cash instead of just acquiring them with cash. So. That whole process was good fun. Really enjoyed presenting the story to the institutional investors, you know, as part of the IPO process. Invariably, when you go through that sort of process, the people you think that are going to take up the stock generally don't. And the ones that you don't think are going to take up the stock from the presentations generally do. So I think they're all pretty good poker players. But that was a great experience, and there were a few learns along the way as well.
Could you delve into that? Like, what were the key learns or the challenges that you had to navigate in order to pull that off?
I mean, the main learn, or the one that sort of sits with me today, sort of several years on, was the understanding of the close relationship with the corporate finance team, you know, which are the advisors for you going through this flotation and IPO process, and their close relationship with the institutional investors. I was probably a bit naive going into that because, and I'll give you an example, all the way through the process, we were all talking about a certain share price, you know, so each share would get a certain amount of money. And this was through all the presentations, through all the projections, forecasts, everything that we had. And then just before the launch date, so just before it was going to be sort of launched onto the stock exchange, we were asked to drop the price of the shares. And it wasn't a massive drop. It was between 10 or 15%. But it was one of those moments where you're so close to the launch and you're suddenly, okay, you think you're going to launch at one share price and you're now being told to secure all the investors, then the launch price has, your share price has to be slightly lower. So that was a, not so much a scary moment, but I mean, it was a moment that I'll probably never forget. But thankfully, you know, we achieved the aim of getting 100% uptake. And that's what we achieved. So it was a very successful launch. But I didn't see that one coming.
What could you explain the significance of that? Like, first of all, why were you being advised that? Was there any ulterior motive, or was that genuinely like why the sudden change compared to what you'd been talking about all along? First of all,
I mean, it's very hard to know exactly the reason, but I can only give you my opinion. I mean, my opinion was that a number of these investors are very close, you know, institutional investors, you know, pension funds and the likes are very close to corporate finance advisors. And I think that, like most people, they're always looking for a good deal. The thing that, like I say, I was probably naive about was that, you know, a good deal gets done very close to the launch date. So I thought that we'd have discussed all of that far more openly leading up to the launch. Mm-hmm. And I can only sort of liken it to selling a house, I suppose, and then at the very last minute somebody says, oh, I'm going to pay slightly less for it. And you're so far down the process that it's very difficult to sort of cut your losses and say, well, no.
Right. Yeah. Good analogy. That makes total sense. So, can you talk through because that's a huge growth trajectory from 10 million to 100 million. So you increased by 10 times in 5 years. Am I getting that time scale right?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. So, what were the key success factors that enabled you to achieve that phenomenal growth rate?
Yeah, it was, I mean, it was part organic, part acquisitive. I think I have to put a lot of it down to the focus of the teams we had and the businesses we bought in. So the idea was to have a selection of specialist teams. You know, originally they had their own brand as they came into the group, but over time they changed to the InterQuest Group brand. And I truly believe that that specialist approach, which is very similar to, you know, what we have at Red, that, you know, when you specialize and you deal within a niche, I just think you've got far better chance of being more successful than being this generalist sort of commodity type service offering. And I often think back, you know, if I hurt my knee or whatever, doing skiing or whatever, I'd want to see a specialist, you know, a specialist consultant who knows a thing or three about knees, you know, not just go see the GP who says, oh, I'm sure you'll be okay, just rest up for a couple of days. So I've always been a big believer in specialist focus, niche markets, knowing your market, knowing the clients, sectors. Where I just believe you can add far more value. And I think that held us in good stead.
Okay, that makes total sense. I agree 100%. So InterQuest Group was made up of a number of specialist teams, each who were experts in their niche market, that understood their market very well, could add more value and be less commoditized in each of those markets. Tell me, why did you decide to grow by acquisition? What's the advantage of doing that?
I think, this probably falls in more with private equity, although this obviously InterQuest wasn't private equity gear. Is that whole arbitration sort of model, you know, that if you've got a company and your enterprise value is, say, I don't know, at the time we were maybe eight or nine times earnings, you start, you know, strategically looking at bolt-on acquisitions, And if you can buy, obviously going to be smaller, so they will have a lower multiple. You know, you can pick these companies up for 3, 4, 5 times earnings, and then obviously they join the group grows, and their earnings are now perceived to be worth 8 or 9 times. So it was a play of growing quickly, and being able to offer clients, you know, a great service by having different mm-hmm. teams focusing on different areas of technology staffing.
Mm. So when you say niche specialist, they were all still within technology. So as an overall business, it was a technology recruiting business.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I had gotcha. Sort of a finance team, a public sector team, or division. So we had, they had different pockets of disciplines and specialisms.
Okay. So now it makes sense. So by making these strategic acquisitions, you can pick up a company, let's say for 5 times earnings, but by the time it's folded into your group, then, it's now worth, maybe twice as much as that. So you're creating value through these acquisitions.
Yes.
But isn't there a downside in terms, it's not easy to integrate all these different businesses, is it? I was part of, when I was in recruiting, I worked for a company called Melville Craig, which was acquired by TMP in 2001. TMP went through this massive sort of acquisition, trail around the world, buying up lots of businesses. Mm-hmm. And then they've since become Hudson Global. But, I remember at the time just observing, it seemed like there was enormous amount of difficulties and hassles trying to bring all these different companies with different cultures, all together. What was your experience of that?
Mm-hmm. That sounds a very familiar story, Mark, that one. my experience, because I'd been through this with MPS. I mean, at the time, okay. When I was with MPS, I remember they went through a year where they made 26 acquisitions, so an acquisition wow. every other week. Now, this was mainly in the US. So I'd seen a lot of these things happen and the pitfalls. A couple of things that I tended to focus on is one, I made sure that I did the management due diligence. So we obviously had lawyers, accountants, to go all through the numbers and to make sure the contracts, the companies we had, there was no skeletons in the cupboard with bad liabilities. But I spent a lot of time on the management due diligence to make sure, culturally, could these guys integrate with us? Are they the right people to integrate with us? First thing, spotting the gap of the service offering that we need. So once you've sort of got a tick in the box, yes, that's the service offering we need and we want to buy it in opposed to take a number of years to grow organically. So spot the gap. And then the management due diligence, like I say, was something that I really focused on. And, on a number of these acquisitions, the owner who owns, the major shareholder, say he's the managing director of it, owns 70% or 80%, is trying to say to you that they want to stay with it once you acquire them. And of course, the more you get to know the person, you think, well, you might think you do now, but you're used to running your own show. You're going to be integrated into a company that's a PLC. There's a lot of disclosure things when you're on the stock market. And there's going to be certain policies and things that we do that you can't just do whatever you want to do whenever you want to do it. So, there was a lot of reality check with people of the saying that they wanted to stay with it. And I had to say, well, no, stay for the first 6 months, but it's not going to be right for you. And you just got to trust me. You can't see that at the moment. Unfortunately, I think I can. So you're absolutely right. The integration is very important, and it's very important up front to try and foresee potential pitfalls before the relationship really does start to move together. And I've seen it with owners that, you know, the minute you give them a Samsonite suitcase full of cash for their business, the next morning they haven't got quite the same spring in their step. You know what I mean? They worked for 10 years or 20 years to build up this company. You've just given them a load of money for it. You know, their sort of journey is complete on that particular project.
Yeah. Okay, no, that makes sense. So there's pre-acquisition, there's the management due diligence. And what else are you looking for in the management team, apart from the MD who's probably going to exit the business? What else are you assessing to decide this is going to be a good fit for us?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things was always looking for the second tier and seeing how much energy and passion have they got for the business. And once you lift the lid off the second tier, are they going to explode and you know, have a great career? So always keen to understand who are the ones that are actually going to be the driving force for the next journey. You know, you look at all these situations and there was a journey to them going to this acquisition, and then there's the journey once they get integrated into the group. And it's really making sure that these are guys that haven't peaked. You know, their careers haven't peaked. They've still got a long way to go. And they're full of energy and they want to learn. And, you know, lifting the lid off of them gives them that chance to really grow and show what they can do, you know, with the right coaching and obviously the right mentoring.
So absolutely. So I guess reverse engineering this, thinking about owners who would like to exit at some stage, then having that strong second tier in place must be one of the critical factors, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
So then post-acquisition, though, I've seen, not been involved at close hand, but from afar, there's often a lot of staff turnover and a lot of, you know, people who don't like the new, they like the way, the old way, they don't like the new way. How do you do the sort of change management piece post-integration to try and, you know, keep the things that were good about the original business that made you want to acquire it in the first place?
Yeah, that, I mean, there is a bit of an art to that. And I think, yeah, very much at the start of this acquisition, it's okay, are we acquiring this company because it's a good company and we're going to help it be a great company? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And if that is the case and we're acquiring it because there's a certain service offering that they've got that we have not already got, then, you know, it makes it easier to work with them and turn them into a great business, opposed to, well, we're just buying up critical mass. You know, we've got enough. You know, this service offering, we do it across the UK. We're buying you guys in France because we don't do it in France. So, and we want you to fall in line with all of our processes and commission structures and everything we do. So we were very fortunate that what we were acquiring in was a specialist in a certain area, which didn't mean that they have to have everything exactly the same as everyone in the group. So each division and each business unit had a certain amount of autonomy or different ways of going to market because it had a different service offering. So there wasn't the need to one size fits all.
Yes, that makes a lot of sense. Okay, fantastic. And then tell me about do you remember the day that you floated? What was that like?
It was brilliant. It was, you know, it was sort of 2.5 years, I think, or 3 years of work to get there, and we'd finally got there. And I remember, you know, the three of us, or four of us, I should say, on the board at the time. One of them had a bottle of red wine that dated back to, I think it was 1970. and he said, right, you know, we're going to drink this red wine. So I opened the red wine. Unfortunately, it tasted awful. I'm not quite sure. It obviously been something was wrong with it, corked or, but you know, this thing was sort of 38 years old or whatever, and it tasted horrible. But we then went out and had a really nice dinner and started, obviously, like you always do, you sort of, well, that's great, you know, really enjoyed it. Right, what's next, you know? And it was very much focusing right. on the new world.
That quickly. I was going to say, euphoria last before you then go back to real, like, okay, now what's next?
Yeah, I think it got as far as dessert.
Okay, wow, that's cool. And then another couple of years of building that business. And then you moved on to Hortons. What do you feel was your major contribution in that position?
That's a good question. It'd be interesting what the managing partners think it was. My take at the time was that they didn't have a group CEO, so it was a really interesting dynamic of a business. And they said, you know, would you be our first CEO? So you know, obviously I met with the shareholders and tried to understand what it was they were trying to achieve. And it was really to put together a strategic plan for the 32 sort of countries, or I think at the time it might have been 27, and since then sort of added more countries. Putting that plan together was something that I really enjoyed doing, and I believe added a lot of value, as well as bringing in or attracting a number of new partners to the group. I mean, the German business was a really good business for to join the grid, a very large company. So that was probably one of the highlights, was bringing in the German partner. But the strategic plan was something that took several months to put together. And, you know, you can obviously understand the challenges of having 32 different countries and the cultures within 32 different countries. And each managing partner, or each country managing partner, had a significant shareholding in that country's business. So that was sort of an interesting dynamic as well. And all the managing partners, their businesses were at a different development stage in their country. You know, some were very small, some were very large and had been around for years in those countries. So their businesses were in a different development stage. Their own careers were in different development stages, which meant the, you know, quite often the country goals were very different to the group goals. So trying to align those two was more difficult than what I initially anticipated. And I think that's why it took several months, or maybe 8 or 9 months, to finalize this 3 to 5 year strategic plan, which all culminated in me presenting it at a global conference in Washington, D.C., and experiencing one of those moments, Mark, where you think, right, okay, I'm really not sure how that's gone down, because, you know, you're presenting to an audience, which all great people, but you know, some give you the nodding head and some do nothing. They just look at you. And you're not quite sure whether they're understanding what you're saying, because obviously there's language difference, although, you know, most of them, if not nearly all of them, spoke English, but obviously some better than others. But thankfully, you know, the plan got unanimous approval by shareholders and managing partners, and you know, personally, I felt delighted that had happened. And, you know, it's a great company, Horton International, great bunch of guys and girls. But I got to a stage, I think it was 4 years, that I felt that I'd taken it as far as I could take it. And then the Red opportunity came about. So, I chose to join Red.
I did a poll on LinkedIn recently to find out what fee percentage recruiters charge, and it confirmed what I'd learned from speaking with so many recruiters every day. The majority of recruiters are undervaluing their service and cutting their fees to become more competitive. Listen, if you want to protect your cash flow and build reserves to protect your business against whatever might happen in the future, you need to be earning more for each placement, not less. The challenge, of course, is how to increase your fees and still be competitive. iIntro has helped hundreds of recruiters to make small but critical adjustments to the way they pitch and win business so they can win more clients who are also willing to pay higher fees. For example, one of their clients typically earned £5,000 per placement, but just a few weeks after working with iIntro, she won a new piece of business on a retainer. So in other words, she got a deposit, and her fee was an incredible £20,000, four times her average. If you'd like to see how iIntro can help you to grow your recruitment business and increase your average fees, just go to recruitmentcoach.com/retained and book a free consultation. There's no obligation. And if you mention that you're a listener of the Resilient Recruiter podcast, iIntro have pledged to offer you a 25% discount off any of their services. Just go to recruitmentcoach.com/retained to get started. All right. Well, look, we're definitely going to talk about Red because that is current and it's a very dynamic and interesting company. Before we do, I would like to learn more about your strategic planning process, because as you were talking, I was getting a feeling of deja vu. I have a mentor called Romney Roz. I don't know if you have come across him in the industry.
Actually, I came across Romney early days of InterQuest.
Ah, okay. So Romney's retired now, and he lives half the year in the south of France and half in the south of England. But so he's a lovely, wonderful guy. Hugely experienced, and he helped me put together a program called Recruitment Growth Accelerator, which is now an online course. One of those modules is about strategic planning to make your business grow, and it's about how to do a sort of 3 to 5 year strategic plan. And at the time, and he's been involved similar to you in mergers and acquisitions and IPOs and trade sales and so on. And I thought that was a Romney Roz thing, but clearly there's, that is an idea that you had independently as well. So why do you need a strategic plan? What does it do for the business? And then what does it contain?
Yeah. I mean, just talking specifically without giving too many of Horton's secrets away, Horton is understanding the start position. I think in all businesses, you've got to say, okay, well, you might have this ambition and you might want to get to a certain place, but let's have a reality check. You know, where the hell are we starting from? Because Horton had not had the CEO in the past, it was doing very well, but there was no glue really holding it together with a clear direction. Mm-hmm. So we didn't have that leadership, or that one person to blame, whichever way you want to look at it. And it was, the thing that was needed was, one, to glue these 32 countries a bit closer together. Two, looking at the strengths of the business, and each country had some great global clients, but the group wasn't doing enough with those clients globally. If that makes sense. So each country would say, "Yeah, we do a lot of business with this global client," but other parts of the group were just not really engaged or involved. So a lot of it was collaboration. Putting forums together or putting plans together or putting, we had a new website. We had, in those days, an intranet that pulled everything together. So like I say, for that type of business, it was far more about understanding the strengths and making sure that we could maximize those strengths and get greater collaboration. And one of the other points, which I must admit, I've not looked at the plan for several years, so I can't remember, 4 years or so, I can't remember exactly everything that was in it. But one of the things that I did spend time with people on is something that I called self-optimization. So making sure that the managing partners were doing the part of their job that they could add the most value, and not doing lots of process things that people, dare I say, sort of below them in the business could do and would rise to do. So there was a big drive on, are you doing the right things? What should you delegate? And if you've got 20 odd years or 30 years in executive search, you can certainly hold your own in front of some really big clients. So let's get you in front of those clients more than, back in the office, monitoring the headhunting that's going on or the resourcing or delivery. So there was a combination of elements, lots of different elements, but it wasn't a rocket science strategic plan. It was one of really assessing everything and understanding everybody's views on things and then building up a plan that everyone could see that it could add value to their own business as well as the group. But the main thing was, I think, was the collaboration.
Cool. All right. So you obviously did a, but then how did the process take 9 months? Let me put the question differently. If you're advising a CEO that they need a strategic plan, what are the steps involved in actually creating and delivering that?
Well, the time was, I think it took probably about 6 months to put together, and then the global meeting was 3 months after it was ready. So I thought, well, it's easier to wait for the global meeting where everybody's coming into Washington and can see the whites of everybody's eyes as we go through the plan and start to work on parts of it together as sort of workshop sessions. So there were times where just one call in those days it was a Skype call, obviously, just one call with a managing partner doesn't give you the real feel of that country's business and what the potential is. So it really was the 6 months. I mean, obviously we were driving through and growing the business, but it was the rapport. It was gaining the rapport, the trust, that the real inside track to make sure that when the plan was announced, that I really felt that I'd looked under every stone. I'd had time to get to know people and sort of copiously make notes of discussions that I had. And then obviously a month later, if it suddenly isn't the same, the information changes, you think, well, why has that changed? And so it was growing the relationship.
So Ross, the real benefit of your role was all these separate businesses, different countries weren't all talking to each other, whereas you were talking on a regular basis with everybody. So you were in a unique position to be able to see the opportunities and, where everybody could, for example, collaborate to increase the overall revenue and profitability and so on.
They were definitely all talking to each other. So that was something that was happening before I joined. So absolutely that there was a lot of discussions happening, but there wasn't one person as a focal point to follow up on things or to try and make things happen. So I think credit to the shareholders, to start with by saying, right, we do need a group CEO. So they'd identified the need for the person. Mm-hmm. And straight away, having a warm body in that position would help, even if he or she starts off as being the go-to person. So, you know, it was credit to them for identifying that. And then obviously I had to make sure that I could pick up on everything and help them and assist them to, keep things moving and get things moving at a faster pace.
All right. Interesting. So, Ross, what was it that attracted you to join Red?
Yeah. I suppose if I look back, I started off in technology recruitment just over 30 years ago. So doing the Horton role, which although we had technology within, it was executive search. So it was different to tech sort of staffing. And my belief has always been firm on this niche sort of business and niche focus. And I knew Red's journey. I'd known it. I mean, it's 21 years old now. I knew Red before it even started. When I was at MPS, we acquired a business called IT Link, which was an SAP staffing business. And the owners or the founders of Red, at least one of them was at IT Link just before we acquired it, and he'd left to set Red up. When I was at Interquest, I gave him a call to see if we could acquire Red, but I was probably about 2 weeks too late. They'd already gone into an agreement with Inflection, private equity firm. And I've always known people at Red, and I've always sort of admired the brand and the sort of the focus and the opportunity. So when I got approached about it, it's all about timing, these things, Mark. I get approached, and I have been approached over the years for different roles, and the timing has just been wrong. And this time, I'd done my sort of 4 years when I thought it would be a 5 year stunt with Horton, and the timing just seemed right. And I certainly would not have gone to a large generalist recruitment firm. And I say Red came up, and I say niche focused, and ticked all the boxes.
Mm-hmm. All right, awesome. So yeah, specialist, which is something we both believe in. Tell me about how you've been able to steer Red Commerce through the pandemic and beyond, because this has been a really tough, an unprecedented, 12, 18 months. So how do you think you've been able to achieve that?
Yeah. If I think back, if we sort of go back to whatever it was, March last year, our financial year starts 1st of April. So it goes 1st of April through to end of March. And of course, I think we can all remember it was sort of mid-March or third week in March that the wheels fell off and everyone, lockdown started. And of course, we'd gone through our budgeting process to start our new budget on the 1st of April. And all of a sudden, the world was changing. So I like to think we were fortunate in a number of ways and just very quick at making things happen in another way. And the things I think we're very fortunate, but we've got a great technology department within Red. We've got great systems. And everything we have is accessible from any location. So everything's based in the cloud. And it was very, very easy to go to remote working, I feel we were blessed that we had all that set up prior to the pandemic, and got a great HR team and leadership team. So straight away, internal communication, was always going to be very high from the minute everybody started to work remotely. And from my own sort of perspective, I'd been through three previous slowdowns, stroke recessions, and I knew that I knew what we had to do. It was just, can I make sure that everybody's confident in what I'm going to be asking them to do, and is the trust level and the belief there. And they were the things that I really had to make sure that our leadership team, everybody had the trust, the belief, and the view that, Ross has got enough experience; he should know what to do. So that was a great kind of start point. The other thing that was good was, and this was a fellow country person of yours, Mark. It was a lady in Canada who I'd known for a number of years. Explained to me, she said, Ross, she runs a small SAP sort of project business in Canada, and she said, we're very fortunate because SAP projects are like IT pregnancies. And I thought, right, okay, not quite sure what you mean by this, but anyway, she went on to further explain that, you know, once you start an SAP project, I mean, they are big, it's big money, but obviously it's a big return on investment that the companies are looking for. But Predominantly, once that project has started, because so much has gone into getting the thing off the ground, it really has to go to the end, you know. And she was saying it's like a birth of a child, you know, once the pregnancy starts, you know, it has to go to the end. And she was absolutely right. You know, we had a number of people working on projects, and yes, you know, not all the companies were in the most resilient of sectors, but you just look at, you know, to have SAP as your core system, you've got to be a pretty sizable business. We were fortunate that we didn't suddenly wake up one morning and find out that we had a number of contractors in, you know, a factory in Germany, and the factory gets closed down because everybody's working from home and all the contractors get sort of laid off. So we're very fortunate that wasn't the case. But when I look back on the year, I think it was, there was definitely two halves to the year. You know, there was the first half, I want to say to the year, I mean, from the 1st of April, so the first of our financial year. From the 1st of April, very quickly put in what I called our H1 sort of 6-point strategy, and it was very much focused on six things. And obviously the first one, revenue, you know, to make sure we can keep the lights on. There was one on clients, you know, the clients that we're focusing on, identifying ideal client profiles. So ones that we know are going to see through the pandemic or perform better than others, looking at, we had project trackers, what projects were in danger of being cut short, which ones just had to keep going. You know, so it was, the analogy was, which of these projects are oil tankers that have just left the port, you know, so it's going to take them a while to turn around, and which ones are just little speedboats that can turn around very nimble. So there was a lot of effort put on that. We put a lot of effort on focusing what we call our staff card, so headcount of, were there people that their job had sort of disappeared for the short term, so should they be put on furlough? Were there people that were sort of ineffective? And we didn't have that many people on furlough, but there were some clear positions that when we were not in the office, they couldn't do their role if we were not in the office. So we were as fair as we could with furlough, and also did a bit of a top up of salary for a number of people that were above the maximum on furlough. Probably like most companies, you know, non-critical spending was another thing that we very much focused on. Cash conservation, which I think every CFO in the land was being told that, you know, they've got to conserve their cash wherever they can. And, you know, very important was the whole communication thing, you know, internally, as well as with candidates and clients, but the internal communication was a real big thing, and I was really pleased that everybody pulled together, and certainly in the early days seemed to adapt very quickly to this sort of remote working, remote forums. I mean, prior to that, I think my last trip in the US was February, so just before the pandemic broke. And I was going to the US once a quarter. You know, I've got three offices in Germany. I was in Germany sort of probably once a month or once every 6 weeks. And with all that stopping, was strange, but it did enable me to have three or four meetings a day, you know, over Teams or Zoom meetings in three or four countries, you know. So what would normally be a trip that would take a week in the US, you know, those meetings could be done in a couple of days on Teams, and even fit in the middle of the two US meetings a meeting with somebody in Germany. You know, so it was adapting. Yeah, I think it was really adapting, and really pleased that our staff were able to adapt. Which I say, so that was great for the first half, and then moving on to I think it was probably about late summer where it became clear that the pandemic had forced a number of companies to start ploughing money into technology and automation. Mm-hmm. So, you know, sort of seeing that happen gave us the opportunity to then, okay, still be cautious, but, you know, the next 6 months was going to be a focus on what I call a defensive growth strategy. So, you know, we were certainly not out of the woods, but we could see that we could still grow and where the opportunities were. So that had some good successes with not only SAP staffing, but we started to look a bit more on what I call adjacent technology. So looking at clients that have SAP, but they've also got some other cloud software products or other products that sort of bolt into their core system, and they've got needs, and we've been this great partner for them at SAP, and they said to us, you know, can you help us out with these adjacent technologies? So that's been a good area for us to expand and add more value to the client, you know, the current clients. So those things have worked really well. And when I think of the risks, I think at certainly the last 12 months, the biggest risk has been for me is, you know, there's one thing knowing what you need to do, but it's quite a different thing actually making sure that everybody buys into it and does it, and does it to the best of their ability. So I'm very thankful to everyone in Red because, you know, people have stepped up to the plate. And you know, it's been challenging, you know, this whole lockdown, the mental health side. I mean, it's been extremely challenging for everybody. But like I say, I'm thankful that we've got a team that's bonded and we have the resources, you know, with our HR teams and technology teams to give what I believe the best support our staff need.
And so, Ross, what have been the sort of changes within Red that even when, you know, people go back to the office and things return, you know, more like normal, then what are the things that you'll keep?
I think there's been a lot of learns and a lot of learns from, let's say, adapting to environments, you know, in different countries and the way that we work. So the return to the office, you know, we have people working back in some of the offices now. There is certainly no mandate that says you must work in the office. You know, this is out of them wanting to work there and teams working together. So I think we'll be in the hybrid model, certainly for the next few years. And I really want to see how this sort of pans out and even turn it on its head a bit to say, if someone's in the office, why the hell are you here? Why are you in the office and not working remotely? You know, and if it's, well, I'm in the office because I'm meeting with the team and we're doing this, and fine, great. But if you're in the office just to do the job that you could do from home, then I don't mind you being in the office, but I think we are turning the whole situation on its head, and not making people think that they've got to go through a commute just because, oh, well, I've got to be in the office more. It's got to be more of a need to be there. So it's still early days. And I think, like a lot of these things, that instead of making things mandatory, you know, there's the option, and then things start to move in the best way for people to be productive and the best way for them to be super successful. And then the thought processes start to crystallize and, okay, well, maybe these should be the policies moving forward, or this should be the norm, you know, not complete to do whatever you like, you know. But I think we're too early on that. And we've been very successful. I mean, we've grown, the sort of quarter, January, February, March, was nearly, I think it was just under double digit growth year on year, the quarter the year before. We started this financial year obviously very strongly. There isn't a need in the business to try to instruct, because they're all doing a very good job at the moment. And obviously I'm very grateful for that.
Fantastic. So thank you for explaining. You've mentioned some of the success factors that have contributed to your actually doing well during the pandemic. What would you do differently if you got a chance? Like what would you say, looking back with hindsight, you would do differently?
I've not given that much thought, to be honest. And there isn't anything, you know, which is unusual for me, because normally I think, right, okay, oh, I wish I'd done this or I wish I'd done that. Yeah. And I'm a big believer in have no regrets, you know, and I can't identify anything that we haven't done that if I had our time again last year, we would have done. I think that, you know, we were very quick to put the right things in place and to try and protect the business and as many people's jobs as we possibly can. I think that served us well. I think we were you know, generous with topping up furlough pay. I think we were as fair as we possibly could be to people in the business. And, you know, that mantra of, you know, treat people as you'd like to be treated yourself. And I feel that so I'm pleased with all of those things. And I just hope that everybody, which I think they will do across every company, you know, reflect on how they were treated through this. And that, you know, that I think is really important. You know, how was I treated? We could have taken a different approach. I know there was mass redundancies and lots of things happening in the market this time last year. But I'm pleased we didn't need to do that. And two, we sort of held our nerve with our plan and pushed through the best way we could. So nothing sort of stands out, Mark, but I'd probably need to think that through a bit more.
So listen, I think what you just said is huge, because many companies perhaps overreacted, or, you know, I suppose when you're in that crisis, it's hard to really know the right course. But I feel like there were a lot of redundancies, which now that the market has bounced back, everyone's trying to hire again. Those companies that were a bit more ruthless may find it harder now to attract the staff that they want. So it sounds like you made some good decisions in that regard. I'm looking at, by the way, at the redsapsolutions.com website. You've got a really good Work for Red page, which outlines your employer value proposition. What do you think is the key? Because growing a successful recruiting business, you know, does largely depend on being able to attract and retain really good people. What do you think are the secrets to doing that, because so many in our industry get it wrong, unfortunately.
Yeah, I try to look through this, through a lens of when I was a sales guy. When I first came into the industry, I can always remember I came in the office at 9 o'clock in the morning. By 11 o'clock, I was on the phone being a 360 sales guy with no experience. And in those days, you had what's called the computer user's yearbook that had all the companies in the UK listed, that what software they had and what their mainframe was at that time. How things have changed dramatically. I mean, first thing in red, the sales guys, it's the 180 degree model. So we've got a big delivery team, same size as delivery team. So people coming in, if they're coming into delivery, we've got some great internal trainers. We've got desk side coaches. We've got all the tools and all the systems to make them as successful as possible. So I'm really pleased that there's a good induction and good training programs for people without experience coming into delivery, and then also ones that want to make the transition from delivery to sales. I've always tried to look at, in all the businesses I've been with, to say, okay, can I make sure that a sales guy in our company will be more successful here than anywhere else? You know, everyone's got limitations of their ability, but have we got the right brand, which I believe we have? Have we got a good market for them to focus on? And have we got the right development for them? So career path development, the training, and I believe we have that. I mean, obviously, it's a continuous improvement. You're always looking to improve it where you can. But I believe we've got all the tools for people to be super successful. And it's just really the application, and I think we've all seen, I haven't seen so many recently, but we've all seen over the years people that suddenly their get up and go has got up and gone, so they need to be motivated to do the job. We're spending time, obviously, developing them, motivating them. But that really leads in for me, Mark, to growth. If you grow, you give people a chance to grow their careers. And I love to see, have a company that's growing and people in the company growing at the same pace that the company's growing. Mm. So they're being developed, they're taking on bigger tasks. And that's why I've always been a great advocate for growth, because if you don't grow,
yes,
and you stagnate, then there really isn't a lot of career opportunities for people. They're just kind of, as someone leaves, they might get the next job. Whereas a growing business gives everybody the opportunity for a great career.
100%. In fact, it's really interesting because so often I speak to recruitment business owners and they tell me things like, Mark, I'd like to grow, but not, we don't want to get too big. Just like to have a nice size business, maybe, and whatever that size is for them, they'll give me a number of 20 people or whatever it is they want. And I say to them, well, look, if you're going to bother growing at all, rather than just have a lifestyle business, which is, generating a nice income for you, if you are going to grow, why put any limitations on it? Why not really go for it? Because the problem you'll run into is attracting and retaining the best people. If there's no continuous career development for them, then how are you going to keep hold of them? So you almost have to grow in order to get the best people.
Totally agree. And you got to be sensible about it. And my view has always been this sustainable growth model is what you want. You don't want something that suddenly spikes up so quickly because it's going to drop at some stage so quickly. So is the whole sustainable growth path underpinning it, and just making sure that you've got a good, solid platform to keep taking the business to the next level. We've achieved that at the moment with Red. Even today, we're on the highest number of contract people, runners that we have out doing work, working on our behalf. And you know, it doesn't seem to be stopping anytime soon. So,
that's amazing.
It's great to just keep that sustainable and underpinned properly.
Did you guys have much of a hit with IR35? Because a lot of IT recruiting firms that I've spoken to, that was a major headache for them, mainly because clients seem to overreact or get concerned about their risk, their liability, and that really decimated their number of runners, at least in the short term. How I know that's a big conversation, probably more we have time for that today. But what was the impact for you guys?
I'll try and give you the short version. I think the short version is, we've got a good legal team, and they were very well versed on what we need to do, way before we needed to do it. So it was great. Okay. So we were ahead of the game on that side. Secondly, although we have a lot of people based in London, we have teams in London that focus on mainland Europe. So at the last count, I think it's about 11% of our revenues come from the UK. So that's pretty small compared to obviously the group. And the third point I would say is because we have people doing what I would call mission critical roles, senior, very sort of senior project roles. SOWs have played a big part in the way that we put contracts together. So our exposure to IR35 was always going to be a lot lower or a lot less than a number of other staffing companies. And I'm sure if I went through all the detail, we have had a hit somewhere along the line, but it hasn't been thankfully material for us to say, oh, right, there's a big blip there. I think we did what we needed to do when we needed to do it, and we were not exposed massively to IR35 from the get-go.
Well, that's great news. Glad to hear that. Ross, we're out of time for today, but I've really enjoyed meeting you. So thank you for taking the time to share your 30 years experience and some of the real nuggets in there. So that's been great. Thank you so much.
Pleasure.